Today's show is brought to you by Audible. Visit audiblepodcast.com/auctionpodcast for your free audiobook download.
Hi, everyone. This is Martin Willis with the Antique Auction Podcast. And Phyllis is not with us today. Unfortunately, she couldn't make it in this morning. And I'm here with John Bemis from Russo and Steele. Russo and Steele is out of Scottsdale, Arizona, and it's one of the biggest collector car companies. Hey, how you doing, John?
Oh, good morning. I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. And let's talk about the beginnings of the company.
Well, Russo and Steele started about 10 and a half years ago. Drew Alcazar is the founder and part owner of the company. Tenure started at Bear Jackson as the general manager for several years, and reached a point where he thought that a more intimate auction, for enthusiasts, by enthusiasts, sort of a deal was in order. So he started Russo and Steele in 2001. Was our first auction in January.
Now that was in Scottsdale.
Correct. Correct.
And is that where Drew was from?
Yes, we're all from Scottsdale. So he envisioned a smaller, more intimate auction, like you said, more about the cars than about the event itself. Initially, we specialized in European sports, American muscle, hot rods, and customs. We continued growing the auction for the last 10 years to where now it's. We've done auctions on the East Coast, on all the way across the U.S. to the West Coast.
Oh. So you actually pick up and just do auctions on location?
We do. We have permanent auctions in, of course, Scottsdale in January and Monterey, California in August during the Pebble Beach events.
Right.
We're actually looking to add two more auctions to our auction schedule, which will be announced later on in the year.
You said you did an auction on the East Coast as well?
We did one in Florida. Hollywood, Florida. That turned out real well, so we enjoyed the East Coast folks as well.
Now, how does a company like yours get notoriety from auctions you've already done and being on the internet when you go to a new location like that?
Yeah, I mean, auctions are really about how you do with cars. I mean, whatever you're selling, whether it be widgets or cars or art, it's all about how well you did in your in your history. We utilize the internet quite a bit. That has become the form in which we're able to convey our message to people globally. I mean, it's just beginning to grow. It's going to take off. We realized that and started many new programs related around the internet. So we're very cognizant of that.
Now, do you have your auctions up live for live bidding on the internet?
We do have. Internet, live internet feeds. We do enjoy proxy bidding and phone bidding. As far as internet bidding in particular, there are some inherent problems still, that exist with that we're not comfortable with in terms of protecting our sellers.
Exactly. I can see. I'm in the auction business, antiques, fine art, things like that, and. We're dealing with mostly lower-end ticket items, and when I say, a $10,000 item or something like that, you can use the system that, for instance, Live Auctioneers has set in place. But when you're talking the kind of money that some of your cars bring, I imagine you really have to qualify the bidders first.
Well, that's exactly right, Martin, and it's really about, the protection mechanism in place for our sellers. It's pretty hard to have an internet bidder without having the collateralization process that you'd have somebody actually in the room in front of you outbid somebody on a $100,000 car, at a $5,000 bid. You got to really think long and hard about the qualifications it takes to make sure that sticks. I mean, you've got somebody that's clicking a button somewhere else in the world. It's kind of hard to ensure that the integrity of that bid.
Sure. Yeah, I can see that. Now, your schedule is Monterey Pebble Beach, and that's in August. And
correct.
One thing that is always a question is, are these auctions open to anybody, and are they free to attend?
Our auctions are open to the public during our preview times. In other words, in Monterey, I'll use that for an example. Our preview areas are open to the public, you know, from bell to bell, we like to say, from first thing in the morning till we close in the evening. We like to invite, you know, the enthusiasts that are, you know, the new hobbyists in the world. We want to foster that, you know, that emotion in the hobby.
Sure.
But when it comes to actual attendance inside the bidding room, whether it be, you know, in Scottsdale or Monterey, we do require that you are a registered bidder or a guest of, because, you know, it really is a serious environment in there, and we don't really want to have you know, a room full of people that aren't capable of buying cars, preventing people that are.
Now, is there a qualification when someone is signing up?
Yes, we have a pretty stringent process that qualifies our bidders in terms of collateralization,
sure,
bank letters, that sort of thing. But it takes very little time, but it does qualify you as a viable bidder and able to pay for your purchases.
Now, I've watched a few videos of your company in the auctions. First of all, there's a couple things I want to say about that. First of all, it looks like a huge attendance of people. And second of all, it's a really high energy auction you have. I couldn't believe all the action that was between the ringmen and the auctioneer, really something. How many people attend your sales that actually are in the bidding room?
Well, Scottsdale is obviously a much larger event. You know, we're doing, you know, close to 700 cars in Scottsdale, and we had the ability to have, you know, a lot more people in the room. So you're looking at anywhere from, you know, 800 to 1,500 people in the room at one time.
Wow.
Whereas Monterey is much more of an intimate environment. You know, it's far less cars. So anywhere from 300 to 500 people.
I see. Wow. Now your facility. Let's talk about that.
Our facility in Scottsdale. Really, we're, you know, we have offices, and there's 8 full-time employees here that you know, that put Russo and Steel on. We don't actually have a showroom to speak of. It's really not part of the collector car auction, you know, mantra, if you will. But you mentioned earlier about the excitement in the room, and that's something that really is the signature Russo and Steel auction. Our auction in the round was sort of created on its own. The very first year we had our auction in 2001 in Scottsdale, you know, we started the general, you know, the old-fashioned way, I like to call it, where, you know, you have people lined up in seats, and the cars are up on a stage, and you know, the auctioneer is asking for bids, and, you know, it's basically what I call, may I have another, sir, please? And we realized right away our clientele was more of a dynamic, more of a probably a younger clientele than what you'd normally see in a collector car auction. And they just said, hey, listen, you know, we want something different. So we just kind of put our heads together and came up with this, you know, invite everybody around the cars and interactive sort of auction environment that just lit off right away. I mean, it just took off. We invited everybody up on the stage the next evening, and it was just a whole different ball game. And from then on, it's just stuck, and it's gone crazy ever since.
I mean, I encourage anyone listening to this to check out Russo and Steel on YouTube and look at some of their videos or their website, which is, can you give out the website, please?
It's www.russoandsteel.com.
I mentioned to you earlier, I had Adam Carolla in our previous podcast on cars, and he was talking about eBay versus auctions and what, you know, his buying habits, and he was saying that he gets carried away at the auctions, you know, because of all the energy and everything like that, and he likened it to a date and marrying someone in Las Vegas the next day, and so do you get people that get kind of carried away with all that energy, and then, I mean, it happens at every auction. Don't be embarrassed to say it. But they get a little carried away, and then later on say, ooh, boy, I really, you know, I really overbid on that. Does that ever happen?
Actually, you know, obviously, probably mm-hmm. and even bids it to a world record price. I've never had anybody feel bad about bidding that kind of money. They're actually excited about it, mm-hmm. about being able to get that car, because when somebody bids that kind of money on a car, there's a good reason for it. You know, there's a reason why somebody bid a world record price on a car, and that's just the way auctions work. I mean, that's how you yeah. get and set world records. You get two people, three people bidding against one another, and they're not just doing it willy-nilly. They're doing it because they know the value and their the attachment to that car.
Yeah, it's an emotional thing, and there's an old saying in the auction business. I grew up in the auction business, and the more you pay, the more you like it. You know,
that's really true. I mean, that's really true. It's the you know, the cars that you know that people you know haven't had an opportunity to really fully you know digest the history of the car and you know do the due diligence and so forth beforehand that are the ones that kind of get caught in that scenario you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, this is my favorite part, is I want to talk about the cars. Tell me about some of the highlights of some of the cars that you've handled at auction.
Wow, that's
a long list, right?
Sort of question. That's my favorite part, too. I mean, I'm my favorites are more of, you know, the weirder stuff, if you will, the stuff you don't see very often.
Uh-huh.
One of my favorites was probably the Bizzarini 5300 Strada that we sold. A couple of years ago in Monterey, nobody really knew what these cars were, and we had one that was just a stellar piece, just a full restoration on a magnificent car, and it set a world record by, oh, I'd say double what the previous car did, and all of a sudden everybody starts looking around going, wow, what is that? And I don't know if you know who Bizzarini was, but he was really the father of the Ferrari GTO.
Oh, wow.
And left to start his own company, which ergo is called Bizzarini. Some of the other cars, you know, were really cool. Were George Fulmer's 69 Trans Am season-winning car.
Mm-hmm.
We sold we were one of the first ones to sell a 73 RS Porsche, which really just set the market on the year. You know, again, just numbers that just had people going, what the heck just happened with those cars? One of my favorite ones was Peter Brock's 65 Shelby Daytona, the prototype car that he actually built with his own two hands.
Wow.
Started that whole Ferrari killer sort of mantra of cars. You know, those are the types of stuff that I really kind of enjoy.
Oh, yeah. Now, I've seen, talking about the Shelby, I've seen a climb in the American muscle cars, what can you tell me about that?
Well, that's just a simple equation of supply and demand. I mean, really good cars like the ones I was just talking about are really hard to find. I mean, cars with pedigree and history that don't have stories are the top of the marketplace. And if you can get one and own one, you're very lucky. So people are paying up for them. And particularly, you know, with the equities markets doing what they're doing now, real estate, stocks, bonds, you name it, whatever you want to name out there, they're struggling, and people are looking for, you know, hard assets,
right?
Good quality hard assets that they can put their money in a safe haven. Mm-hmm. And cars are offering that. The good cars, the no stories cars, like I just talked about. That's why that you're seeing the continued run up in the value of those really good cars, whether it be European sports, American muscle, heavy classics, whatever you want to call it. The best of those markets are continuing to go up because you've got a global marketplace. You've got a worldwide market that realizes that those cars are always going to be worth more than they are today, and there's always going to be buyers for those cars. For example, right now the Euro's having some struggles, but there's other parts of the world, you know, Australia, New Zealand, you know, those types of places that their economies are doing great.
Right.
And they have the ability to buy those great cars. So you're seeing those cars move, you know, all around the world. If you watch the hobby long enough, you'll see the same car sort of surface, you know, in the UK, maybe in China, maybe back here in the US.
Mm-hmm.
But they're constantly being, you know, traded around the world for, you know, in a steady movement.
Yeah.
So there's a good equity there in good classic collectible cars.
Yeah, one of the questions I was going to ask you was how many people are taking their stock money and putting it into the high-end cars. And I figured that must have been happening because I think it's happening in all tangible areas of investing. Seems to be.
It is. It's a very, very clear path. I mean, people have I shouldn't just say the high-end collectors, but the sophisticated investors today have certainly realized this. If you want to use a prime example, just look at gold. My gosh.
Right.
What's pushing $1,300 an ounce?
Mm-hmm.
I would liken collectibles to, somewhat of that same genre of investment. But I don't like to really look at cars as investments.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody asks me, what do I invest in cars? My first question is, what do you like?
That's a good point.
I don't recommend anybody ever buy a car unless they really, really like it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, that's what it's really all about. If you want to buy a Mercedes-Benz Gullwing because you like it,
yep.
That's great. You're probably going to be fine. And 10 years down the road, I'm pretty sure it's going to be worth a lot more money than you paid today. But there should be more reason to buy than just the investment side.
Yeah, well, you're preaching to the choir here because I tell people all the time when they ask me, as far as artwork goes, and I basically tell them the same thing. Why don't you buy what you like? Of course, a really good name helps and all that, but at the end of the day, you're stuck with that thing, and you could be stuck with it if, things change and as far as that particular artwork goes. So as far as investing in about anything like that, when it's more of a thing that you're living with, of course, yeah, something that you like certainly makes sense.
Yeah, and there's no guarantee that, the Mercedes-Benz Gullwing is going to keep going up.
Mm-hmm.
I use that for example because that really is a good indicator of the marketplace. In 10, 100 years from now, everybody's going to know what a Mercedes-Benz Gullwing is, let's face it.
Yeah, they're beautiful cars.
But there's going to be times when the value of those cars are going to ebb and flow. They're going to go up and down. The last thing you want to have is a car that might be worth a little less than what you paid for it for a short period of time or whatever period of time it is.
Mm-hmm.
And you're opening that garage door every day and looking at that. That's just not the right scenario.
Right.
You want to open that garage door and feel good about that car that's sitting there, regardless of what it's worth.
Exactly. Well, I'm sure that plenty of celebrities either bid discreetly, someone represent them at your auctions. I know Adam Carolla, as we talked about before, attended your auctions several times. Are there other people that come to mind, like Jay Leno or anyone like that, that participates?
Well, the celebrities are pretty much all over the gamut. If you use Adam on one side, he's absolutely just a hoot. when he comes, it's a party. He's having fun, and he's really embodying what it is to be at one of our auctions. It's just nonstop hilarity. He's great, and he loves cars. But
yeah.
You've got that end of the spectrum, and then you've got the Jay Lenos of the world,
mm-hmm.
which we deal with everybody in between. But most of the time, the celebrities prefer to be discreet about what they're buying, how much they're paying for it. They'll typically send an agent
sure.
on their behalf.
That's what I thought.
A representative, and that person will notify us that this is for a certain person.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they just do it discreetly, and we
yeah.
find out later that this particular celebrity has ended up with the car.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so yes, definitely yes, we do deal with a lot of high end celebrities, and most of the time they like to stay or be discreet about it.
Sure. Now, speaking of celebrities, what effect on a car's value does it have when it's previously owned by one?
It definitely has an effect. Depending upon the car, it's got to be. It starts with the car.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be a great car to start with.
Sure.
For it to really have a big impact. Great car, great pedigree, and depending upon the popularity of the actor, it all comes into play. So the answer is probably 25% to 400%.
Yep, depending. Have you had any cars that were featured in any films?
Yeah, we've had several. There's the most valuable one we've ever done was probably the Elvis Presley spin-out. Cobra.
Oh, wow.
You know, that car was a very famous car that sold for, oh, we sold that for, I think, over $1 million. You know, we've had a lot of famous race cars. We sold the Earnhardt, Dale Earnhardt's 2004 winning season NASCAR for like a world record price. I don't know, it was like $275,000, I think. A couple of Batmobiles.
Really?
Yeah, those are interesting pieces, I'll tell
you.
Yeah,
I bet.
They're very, very large.
Are they drivable?
Yeah. There's typically when you see a car like that, they'll be, you know, 8 to 10 mock-ups that actually aren't drivable, that don't have drivetrains in them, and then you'll have a couple that actually do drive for the driving scenes. So we've sold a couple of those. We've sold one of the Dukes of Hazzard cars.
The
Boss Hog car. Couple of George Fulmer's Trans Am, 69 Trans Am season winning car, things like that. I mean, we've had a lot of great cars. It's hard to keep track of them all when you're doing, you know, you're doing so many cars every year.
Sure. Now, what's your high record of any car that you ever sold?
Oh, that would be the Cobra that we sold in Scottsdale about 4 years ago, I want to say.
Mm-hmm. Unbelievable.
That's a lot of money for a Cobra, if you watch the Cobra market.
Well, that's a lot of money for anything. Wow. Isn't that something? I saw the video on your website about the windstorm you had last year, and that was a tragedy. Can you talk a little bit about that? But before I have you talk, I wanted to say that the owner of the company, I thought, was very honorable with how he handled that. So why don't you talk about what happened?
It was certainly a tragic ordeal, and you know, at the end of the day, you know, we were really, really thankful that that nobody got injured or worse. I mean, that truly was the bright side of the whole catastrophe. But mm-hmm. I think it was you know, when we put our heads together, you know, after we recouped the next morning, you know, we sort of all decided that we were going to do exactly that. You know, do the right thing, do the best we can, make it about our consigners, mm-hmm. because they were the ones that were really taking the brunt of this. So we switched our gears and made it all about the consigners for the next, you know, 24 hours and let them decide what they wanted to do with their cars, whether they wanted to take them, whether they wanted to rerun them through the auction. And the ones that did want to run them through the auction, we did everything we could possibly do to make that happen. And our ragtag, you know, our ragtag team of people that helped us really pulled off a Herculean feat by putting that auction back together again. And as it turned out, we sold almost $8 million worth of cars in 2 days. And this is this is on a Sunday and a Monday, where, you know, most people had already scheduled to leave. So mm-hmm. you know, we had clients that said, "Hey, listen, you know, we're behind you. We want to show our support." So they changed their travel plans.
That's excellent.
Stayed all day Sunday and all day Monday, and bought cars, you know, at the auction. So, I mean, it was such a good indicator of how loyal our clientele are, mm-hmm. and how strong our the people are that help us. I mean, it was amazing to see this come off.
A lot of people just would have stopped, but I thought that was really good foresight.
Well, I think you're right. I think that you know, most people that I talked to said, "I just can't believe you guys were able to put that back together again and sell that many cars." But you know, Drew's leadership in this thing, you know, it's like every day he says, "You know what? We have a responsibility to those people to sell their cars, and if they want us to try and sell their cars, we are going to do that regardless, no matter what it takes. We're going to get it done, and we're going to fulfill those expectations." And we did, and it was really, really well received by all.
Now, what happened was kind of a rare event?
You know, Scottsdale's kind of a strange place in January. You know, I can remember auctions when it snowed, of all places. But, you know, the weather's the weather. I mean, it can do just about anything it wants to do, and there's nothing you can do about it. Hmm. But that's just, it can be 75 degrees out there, and there's everybody wearing shorts in T-shirts, or it could be, like I said, snowing and everybody bundled up underneath the heater. So, you know, it's Scottsdale in January. That's about the best way to sum it up.
I see. Now, just switching gears a little bit here, no pun intended. Is it only cars that you sell, or do you handle like rare motorcycles, air or watercraft, anything like that?
We tried motorcycles for a couple of years, and just determined that it really wasn't what our focus was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's fun to have them, but we want to keep the focus on what it is that we specialize in, and that's the cars. So No, we don't do boats. We don't do motorcycles or things of that nature. We do have a very well-attended memorabilia auction before each day's
mail. Really?
That we're able to do, other things out of the realm of the car part of it.
That sounds like fun.
It is. It's a lot of fun. We do watches. We do collectibles. We do all kinds of different things.
Uh-huh. Now, have you ever had a single owner sale, which means the sale belonged to just one person, or a large segment of your auction as a single owner?
Martin, we've done many collections. The collections that we do are woven into, each auction that we put together. We don't actually name a part of the auction as, the Martin collection.
That'd be nice.
The people that want to do their collections with us,
mm-hmm.
would much rather be more discreet about it. In other words, they don't want the world knowing that they're selling 30 of their cars. They'd rather have us sell them because they recognize that we're able to get the top of the market for them.
Uh-huh.
But would rather have them woven into the the daily auction that we would be doing that day. So we've done many collections, but we sort of shy away from naming them after a specific owner.
Now, who are your consigners?
Wow. That's a good question. Mostly enthusiasts, mostly mm-hmm. what I would call end users.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at auctions around the country, if you visit auctions around the country, you can get a feel for, a dealer versus end user base. Our dealer versus end user base, we're about a 70-30. So we've got about 30% of our consigners are dealers, as well as buyers. I mean, it works on both sides of the fence. About 70-30, so 30% are dealers, 70% are end users.
Uh-huh.
So our typical consigner, after 10 years, is the collector, enthusiast that has probably bought a car or two from us and has enjoyed it, is ready to move on to the next one, has his sights set on maybe a different car, and is going to sell this car and get another car. So we enjoy a real heavy continued client base, and we like to be a part of their what I would call their level of sophistication in collecting cars.
Mm-hmm.
They often call and ask, I'm thinking about making a change in my collection. What do you recommend? I like these types of cars. I like that type of cars. Or mm-hmm. they'll call and say, hey, listen, it's time to make a move. Here's my 50 cars that I have. I want to move 10. Which ones would you recommend?
Really?
That would be the best ones to move today, and if so, which ones, what cars do you think are best to add to my collection tomorrow?
Wow! So you really
it is very interactive with mm-hmm. with our clients.
You really have to know your market. As being the consignment director there, you really have to know what's going on everywhere in everybody's auctions and all over, huh?
Well, yeah, that's one of the things that we do a lot. I mean, there's a lot of travel involved.
Mm-hmm.
I just got back from a road trip that was almost 5 weeks, just running mm-hmm. around the country and actually the world. I mean, I went and visited Monaco sale, and just to get an idea of what the European collectors were doing. So,
well, someone has to do that. It's a tough job, but someone's going
to
do it.
Well, I mean, if you talk to my wife, it's not the best job in the world, but because you are gone a lot, it's mostly weekend. So.
Now, do you have consigners from overseas?
Yes.
Wow. Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
They're, again, it's back to the what we talked about earlier, and when you're dealing with cars that enjoy a global marketplace, the astute collectors are going to go where the money is. I mean,
right.
Let's face it.
Mm-hmm.
If there's more money in the U.S. than there is
Uh-huh. Now, tell us what kind of car makes sense to sell at auction and what kind of car you just pass on.
Well, we look at those things every day. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, the cars that are well-known in the hobby, again, back to the same thing we talked about earlier, what I call the rock stars or the studs at the marketplace,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're always going to bring the top of the market, and they're always going to be setting new world records. If you've got them positioned properly and you've been able to market them properly in an auction environment, because you are going to have, you know, hopefully 2, 3, 4, 5 people that are interested in that same piece that are going to be fighting amongst each other to get it. You know, when you have a car for offer and it's on private treaty, you know, you have the ability for people to, like you said earlier, to really stop and think about it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let the other things they're thinking about, you know, come into play, whereas you're in an auction environment, you've got, you know, basically seconds to make a decision.
That's right. And I think that's the beauty of auction. A lot of times it puts people right at the point of sale where they have to jump or not, you know.
Well, yeah, and then you're not going to see, again, when you're talking about market valuations, you know, people ask me, you know, what's the car worth? And my friend sold this car for X amount of dollars, and I said, well, that's great. That's great money. That was a great sale, but, you know, it's not recognized amongst the hobby as a valid sale because it's not public.
Right, right.
In a public environment, that does establish the market for the car.
Right. Now, I've noticed that at antique and fine art auctions that prices are really sporadic. I mean, they're not making sense, but there's a reason for that. Do you see that in cars, or is it pretty steady?
Indeed, I see it in cars, and again, it comes back to the integrity of the car, you mm-hmm. know, the history and pedigree. All that comes into play. I know that if you were to put, you know, two Renoirs together, you know, one person, there might be more people like the one on the left than like the one on the right.
Mm-hmm.
It's a similar situation in cars, but typically speaking, you're not going to have two red Daytona Spiders sitting again, you know, sitting side by side, mm-hmm. and having people go, well, I like that one just a bit better. Each car's got its own personality,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and each car, the buyer for each car has his own set of reasons for wanting to purchase that particular car, and sometimes you never know, and cars do strange things sometimes, and you scratch your head going, what just happened there? But there's you know, things that take place behind the scenes that you just don't have any idea about. But to answer your question is, yes, there's a big diversity in the prices of the cars. And 99 times out of 100, it's related directly to the pedigree of the car.
Wow. Now, speaking of that, or I don't know if this has to do with pedigree or not, but when I've gone to car shows and things like that, I've noticed the most beautiful restoration jobs and things that were done to the car that were never done in the factory, you know, when it comes to the painting of the interior or whatever it is, it's like much, much better than it ever was new. Would you still rather have a car in original condition or one finally restored like that?
Great question. The reason that people are over-restoring cars today is because it is cars, you know, have become like art. They're a piece of jewelry to a lot of people. And they're, you know, if you really look to see how a car was finished back in the 60s or 70s versus what the ability and the technology we have today, it's a totally different ballgame.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if it's about the pleasure of the car, I definitely, you know, would prefer an over-restored car versus a car restored to, you know, original, you know, livery, if you will. You know, when I talk to people about an original car, my first question is, tell me about the car. How original is the car? And by the time you get done with the conversation, it's got the original seat covers in it, okay? You know, they've been painted, and this and that. An original, a true original car that, you know, has never been painted, has never been touched. It might have a couple of, you know, mechanical pieces replaced, a water pump, an alternator, whatever. But a truly original car is indeed a true find, I think, that,
mm-hmm.
and it does bring the top of the market. But, you know, there's that whole originality what makes a car totally original? Everybody's got their own view of that. In my view, it's totally original, never been touched. It's got the scratches in the door. It's got the D-Lam paint. It's got the micro-checking. You know, the interiors, the seats are cracked. And the better the car's condition, of course, the more valuable it's going to be. Mm-hmm. There's cars that have been in the wrapper, like I like to say, you know, for 30 years, and they look fantastic. For example, that 330 GT that we sold in January. I mean, it was a one-owner car out of Scottsdale. It had been kept in a garage in Prescott all its life. I mean, you could physically look at the car and see that the paint was faded, but nice, and, you know, it had a lot of nice patina to it, but there was no question about its originality. And that's where I draw the line with an original car.
Have you ever had a car that went through your auction that was a sleeper that no one had any idea in your auction company that it was going to take off, and it just took off?
Well, I guess it's the best example of that, and it's an easy one too, would be when we sold Nick Cage's Black Cuda.
Hmm.
That was about a year and a half ago, I guess it was.
What year was that car?
It was a 70 Hemi Cuda.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And if you're in the hobby, it's a great example because you know what those cars were doing, what they did do, what they're doing now. But at the time, I had conversations about it with Nick and his representatives, and we sort of figured the car would do somewhere around the mid-2s, which was the top of the market for Hemi Cudas at that time. Now, that you got to remember, this is when, right after everything kind of came apart with the banks and all that.
Oh, yeah.
S&L, all that stuff was just kind of coming apart. The stock market was in the tank. So there wasn't that much to be excited about out there, in January that year. And, he said, hey, listen, I understand you guys are the best auction to sell the car. Scottsdale's the place. So I have all the faith in you. You know, let's put a reserve on the car that gets people excited. But I'd like to, I'd sure like to get, in the mid-2s for the car. So we decided on $175,000 reserve. And again, I figured the car would probably blow right by that, doing the mid-2s. The car lit up on the auction block and bounced right by the 175, the 250, ooh, and ended up selling for $440.
Oh, boy.
And now this is at the same time they're at Jackson selling Hemi Cudas the same evening, okay, at their event in Scottsdale. And the spread there was, I believe, was 110 to 160. They sold about three or four cars in that spread, the highest one being 160, the lowest one being 110. So that gives you an idea what the market was at the time. But, it was advertised properly. It was such a significant car. But we didn't realize how well it would do. That was probably the best example of one that just kind of blew us away. We're looking at each other going, wow, that's pretty crazy.
Love when that happens.
Yeah.
Now Scottsdale has, if I am thinking right, Scottsdale has a lot of retired baseball pros there. Is that right?
There's a lot of retired everything here. I mean, let's face it. My background's at a Cadillac store here in town for 30 years, and I think we had every retired GM executive and their families here. So it is a melting pot for retired people with a lot of ball players, a lot of celebrities, you name it. It's just almost 4 million people of different types.
Now, do you get a lot of local participation then?
Yeah, we do, especially for preview. I mean, the growth of Russo and Steele over the past 10 years has just been crazy. It's almost doubling every year. I mean, our attendance, our gate attendance is a good example of that. I mean, every year our gate attendance is doubling, and that is mostly due to the local people that like to come out and take a look at the cars and enjoy the energy and the thrill of being out there at one of the Russo and Steele events. It's very addictive.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of the Black Hawk Museum?
Sure.
Yeah, boy, I'll tell you what. I took a tour of that. I actually did an auction there, not a car auction, but I did a benefit auction there. And, oh, boy, I'll tell you what, they have some very unusual cars in that place.
Don Williams is by far the most noted authority, I believe, in the car world today. He is the apple, the grandfather. He is the godfather of the car hobby. He's,
Wow. Well, you know, we're out of time here. Just a real quick question, last question for you is, what do you think the future of collecting cars will be?
I believe this is just the beginning, Martin. You know, I often use the art world as an example, and, you know, my view is that, you know, with my contemporaries, is that I feel that, you know, I'd much rather have a Daytona Spider in my garage rather than a Renoir. You know,
well,
I enjoy them both, and my wife's a big art collector. But
yeah, that'd be,
you know,
coin toss
both,
for me.
For me, I'd rather have more, you know, enjoyment in having that car and being able to drive it, look at it, and do different things with it.
Hmm.
And I think there's a lot of people of our genre, that our age group, that kind of thinks that same way.
Mm-hmm.
That realize that, you know, it is a good long-term investment if you're buying the right pieces. And I think, though, this is based on that, this is just the beginning of the movement into collector cars.
Wow. Now, why don't you throw out the date that you'll be at Pebble Beach in August?
We're in Pebble Beach in August, the 16th through the 19th of August. We're actually going to be announcing this in the next couple of days, but, you know, we've typically been a two-evening sale, prime-time only, what we call prime-time only lots. A small number, 150 a loss total.
Mm-hmm.
But we've had just a tremendous amount of people that want to be a part of our auction there, and we've been sort of tied down with some logistics there of the event site, but we put some things together and had the ability to add another evening this year. So
wow,
we're very excited about that. We're going to be able to include a lot more people that have been wanting to be a part of it for years now. So we're going to be three evenings.
Nice.
Thursday, Friday, Saturday,
mm-hmm.
16th to the 19th. Monterey, California, downtown at the Monterey Marriott. You're right downtown Monterey, right there by the pier and all that stuff there.
All right. Right. All right. So give out your website and your phone number one more time, if you would, please.
Our website is www.russoandsteel.com.
Now, Steel has an E at the end, right?
Yeah, and it's all spelled out. Russo and Steel, STEELE.
Mm-hmm. And your phone number?
Is 602-252-2697.
Very good. And this is Martin Willis with John Bemis, the consignment director for Russo and Steel. Thank you so much, John. That was very interesting.
Oh, Martin, thanks for having me on. And please, let's get together again.
Yes. And this is Martin Willis, and signing off.
Today's show was brought to you by Audible. Visit audiblepodcast.com/auctionpodcast for your free audiobook download. There are over 75,000 titles to choose from. We thank you for listening today, and we hope you enjoyed the show.